But it is necessary now to make a choice, to choose between two admittedly regrettable, but nevertheless distinguishable post-war environments. One where you got 20 million people killed, and the other where you got 150 million people killed.
That's George C. Scott as General Buck Turgeson in the 1964 film Dr. Strangelove. He's explaining to the president what his nuclear retaliation options are. He needs to know, because an insane general has ordered a B-52 bomber to strike the Soviet Union.
You're talking about mass murder, General, not war.
Mr. President, I'm not saying we wouldn't get our hair mussed, but I do say no more than 10 to 20 million killed, tops.
General Turgeson was based on a real general named Curtis LeMay. He headed the Strategic Air Command, and in 1965, during the Vietnam War, LeMay famously suggested that the North Vietnamese needed to drop in their horns and stop their aggression, or we're going to bomb them back into the Stone Age. As it turns out, LeMay's language has influenced recent diplomatic relationships between the United States and other nations with nuclear capability.
Musharraf says the message was delivered by Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage in the most undiplomatic terms.
What did Armitage say to your Director of Intelligence right after September 11th?
The Director of Intelligence told me that he said be prepared to be bombed, to be prepared to go back to the Stone Age.
In the 1960s, the system designed to protect us from a nuclear strike was built on flimsy safeguards and rapidly failing technology. But in August of this year, CNN's Barbara Starr reported that nuclear missile safety is still tetchy and tenuous.
In Montana, about 3,000 people, about 150 Minuteman III nuclear intercontinental ballistic missiles. This week, the Air Force says the entire wing failed a safety and security inspection. What they will not tell us, because it's so highly classified, is exactly what, quote, tactical errors were made that led to the fail mark on the inspection. They say the nuclear weapons were always safe.
A top-secret document recently published in The Guardian and obtained by investigative journalist Eric Schlosser through the Freedom of Information Act revealed that on January 23, 1961, the U.S. Air Force came perilously close to nuking Goldsboro, North Carolina, because of bombs accidentally dropped from a B-52 bomber. If the device had discharged, the destructive force would have been 260 times more powerful than Hiroshima.
Titan II, the largest and the most powerful ballistic missile in our arsenal. 54 are currently deployed.
33 years ago, the United States came very close again to a nuclear holocaust in Damascus, Arkansas. In a Titan II silo, an overworked airman dropped a socket wrench, which pierced the skin on the missile's fuel tank, causing poisonous oxidizer to permeate through the air. The W-53 nuclear warhead that was mounted on top of the missile came very close to exploding. Thankfully, it was stopped. My name is Edward Champion, and this is the Bat Segundo Show. All of what I'm talking about is documented in Eric Schlosser's excellent new book, Command and Control, which covers the Damascus incident, as well as our reckless history of avoiding safety and taking shortcuts to maintain our missiles. As more nations advance with their nuclear capability, the questions remain the same. Are these nuclear missiles safe? Are the men who maintain these missiles overworked? Are the military leaders wise enough to learn from past historical mistakes? And in our age of terrorism and religious fundamentalism, how much of operational decisions are guided by wild ideological impulse over rationale? Schlosser was kind enough to meet me on a crisp September afternoon in Central Park. Okay, so I am here with Eric Schlosser, who is most recently the author of Command and Control. Eric, how are you doing?
I'm doing good.
Thanks for meeting me. It's a pleasure. It's a wonderful day here in Central Park.
So, it is. Yes. Thanks for getting me out of the house.
Okay. I'm happy to do that. So much of the missile culture that you describe in this book is, to say the least, remarkably unsafe. You have this Arkansas Titan II mishap at Launch Complex 374-7, the so-called Damascus incident that forms the backbone of this book. It all hinges on a socket wrench that is dropped down a silo and pierces this fuel tank. And if that isn't enough, you have oxidizer that permeates around the station, causes 22-year-old David Livingston to die, several men to be severely wounded. You have procedures that aren't followed. You have the propellant transfer system team violating this careful two-man policy where you have two keys turning at the same time. We often see that in the movies, but this was, in fact, the policy during the mid-20th century and onward to activate the missile. So this leads me to ask, I mean, how did the launch complex adopt such a far-from-cautious approach to daily maintenance duties? How much of this was systematic, and how much of this was human error?
You know, our military was in pretty rough shape after the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
And it's a forgotten fact now because we have our precision-guided munitions, and we go to war in one country after another, and we seem so completely dominant. But after the Vietnam War, there was major underinvestment in the military. There were terrible morale problems. Huge percentages of our troops in the Army came back addicted to heroin.
Yeah.
And there were remarkably high levels of illegal drug use, even in the Air Force. So in the book I write about, you know, guys smoking pot yeah. on the missile site, launch officers who had responsibility for launching, you know, intercontinental ballistic missiles
yeah.
smoking pot. In the book I go into, you know, guys were busted with LSD and cocaine who had nuclear weapon responsibilities. And that was part of the bigger culture of the 70s. There was really poor morale. The missile, the Titan II missile that's at the heart of this story, was obsolete. It was supposed to be taken out of service in the late 1960s. In 1980, it was still on alert. It was leaking all the time. They didn't have spare parts. So the accident I write about is precipitated by somebody dropping a socket in a
yeah.
missile silo, and the socket pierces the skin of the missile. But in many ways, this weapon system was an accident waiting to happen. And in my criticism of some of the procedures in the 1970s and early 1980s, I really don't imply a criticism of the ordinary servicemen who worked on these weapon systems. On the contrary, you know, the book is about the incredible heroism of ordinary guys
yeah.
put in custody of nuclear weapons at a remarkably young age. You know, I'm getting old enough now so that when I think of a 19, 20, 21-year-old person having custody of a thermonuclear weapon, it sort of takes me aback. And those guys, again and again in the Cold War, had this responsibility. You know, maybe some of them were smoking pot, but most of them were quite serious about not wanting these weapons to go off and about making sure that we were safe from attack from the Soviet Union.
Yeah. What's fascinating is why so many young and inexperienced greenhorns would be given such responsibility for these missiles. I mean, that's what boggles the mind, especially since there were several other accidents, the B-52s that you
yeah.
Have dropping bombs that thankfully didn't have charged warheads.
Yeah.
I mean, this is very serious. This isn't asking, you know, regular people to go ahead and mop up the floor of a hangar. This is our system. And I'm wondering what conditions allowed this to perpetuate for so long. Also, I mean, notwithstanding the heroism that you depict in your book.
Yeah. The accident that is the central narrative of the book, the Titan II accident in Damascus, Arkansas,
yeah.
was unquestionably linked to understaffing, to poorly trained personnel, shortage of spare parts, an obsolete weapon system. But I write about many other accidents in the book.
Yes.
And in those accidents, they had extremely well-trained personnel. They had the most modern weapons imaginable, the best systems in place imaginable. But one of the big themes of the book is, you know, we're a lot better at creating complex technologies than we are at controlling them or managing them. And it's hard to think of a machine that doesn't mess up, you know, from your toaster oven to your laptop to commercial airliners to commercial nuclear power plants. You know, no matter how sophisticated the people and no matter how well trained, it's just beyond fallible, imperfect human beings to create something that's infallible and perfect. And when you're talking about nuclear weapons, you're talking about the most dangerous machines ever invented.
Yeah.
So it makes sense that those machines and the complex technological systems that manage them would mess up occasionally. But the consequences of one of those things screwing up is a lot more than if your toaster oven catches on fire in the kitchen.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons I wrote the book, I mean, firstly, I thought the story of this missile accident was just unbelievable.
Yeah.
And I thought the heroism of the guys who tried to save the missile was unbelievable. But I'm just trying to remind people that these things are out there. There are thousands of nuclear weapons right now ready to go. And like, you know, people my age, I'm 54, who grew up in the Cold War, remember what it was like to live with this sort of dread that there might be an all-out nuclear war any day. But half the people in the United States either weren't born yet or were small children when the Soviet Union vanished. And there's a sort of historical amnesia, and most people just don't realize these weapons are there. Now, I'm not trying to create an existential dread in anybody. I'm not trying to, you know, create late night anxiety, but this is really important information, and people need to know it.
But even in the 1950s, you have this guy named Fred Eckley. He disseminates this RAND report on nuclear weapon safety, and he outlines all the motivations that would cause someone to disobey orders and set off a nuclear weapon. His reports were disseminated, as you point out in the book, to the highest level of the Air Force and the Department of Defense. You have this guy named Bob Purifoy. He points to numerous safety problems as well. Your book, as we've established, documents several incidents in which safety is sacrificed for ease of intercontinental ballistic missile use and retaliation. Why was the top brass so recalcitrant against safety? Why were they so interested in taking shortcuts? I mean, it seems to me that it goes beyond a kind of cultural problem or an institutional problem and into just pure recklessness.
Yeah. And that top secret report by Eckley was really cool to read.
Yeah.
I mean, it was looking into the ways that not only mechanically these weapons could go wrong, but I think in one section of the report there's a catalog of derangement, which is looking at what sort of psychological problems airmen might have that would lead them to deliberately set off a weapon, deliberately steal a weapon. And at the time that Eckley was writing, literally, there were no locks on our nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
There were no coded switches, so a pilot who wanted to take a weapon could just fly it to the target in the Soviet Union, in the Eastern Bloc, or even in the United States and just drop it if he or she wanted to do that. And Eckley's report was important in one respect. It really encouraged what you'd think would be a no-brainer, but nobody had thought of doing, putting locks on the weapons.
Yeah.
Now, the locks that were eventually put on them, these coded switches called permissive action links, they were effective, but to someone who really understood the innards of the weapon, in a few hours they could disable it. Robert Purifoy is one of the heroes of the book. He's a weapons designer at one of the weapons labs, Sandia National Laboratory, who realized in the late 1960s that our nuclear weapons just weren't safe enough.
Yeah.
And that during what is called an abnormal environment, I mean, you could argue that the whole history that I write about in the book is an abnormal environment, but at the weapons labs, they refer to abnormal environments as a fire, the submersion of a weapon.
Amazingly, no acronym.
a plane crash, right, yeah. A lightning strike. He realized that our weapons were not safe enough in these abnormal environments, but it took him like a 20-year bureaucratic battle to get modern safety devices put in the weapons, which we now have today, but you would never build a nuclear weapon today in the United States without these sorts of safety devices. Ultimately, at the heart of the problem, firstly, is a sort of bureaucratic mentality. Someone said recently to me, you know, if you want to understand how bureaucracies work, it's better to be wrong than be alone. So it takes somebody with some personal courage to stand up, willing to buck the bureaucracy and be alienated from everyone else as a result. And there also has been, since the very first nuclear weapon was deployed, a sort of internal contradiction and tension between wanting the weapons to be as safe as possible and wanting them to be as reliable as possible and available for immediate use. You know, if you wanted the weapons to be totally safe, you would never fully assemble them until you're about to use them.
Yeah.
But if you want to use them within 45 seconds or a minute, you need to have them fully assembled on top of the missile or inside the bomber and ready to go. So in the book, I talk about this, you know, internal tension between always wanting to be able to use the weapon and never wanting it to go off by accident. And again, throughout our nuclear history, the military preferred always to never. And some of it I can understand. I mean, these bomber pilots knew that if they got the order to go bomb the Soviet Union, they would be flying into an environment that no pilot had ever flown into before. Missiles would probably have already hit the Soviet Union. They would be flying into this, you know, atomic wasteland in many ways to drop their bombs, and probably were on one-way suicide missions to do so. And yet they were willing to do it. And it would be a bummer for them if they risked everything to take out a Soviet airfield and that weapon turned out to be a dud because there were too many safety devices on it. Having said that, you know, I would have voted for greater safety. Robert Purifoy, the Sandia engineer, felt like we could make the weapons reliable enough and still make them much safer. And eventually, his view prevailed, but it took almost
decades.
Yeah. And I think it really hurt his career. He wound up being a vice president at this weapons lab, but he was ostracized. It hurt his career. And I think it was enormously stressful for him to live with this constant knowledge that one of our weapons might detonate and be trying to fight the system to make them safe. And he prevailed, but, you know, it was a pretty stressful job.
Let's talk about Curtis LeMay, this remarkable guy. He was the real-life inspiration for General Buck Turgidson in Dr. Strangelove. He was a man who wanted every last dollar to be spent on bombs and bombers for the Strategic Air Command.
Yeah.
He told Kennedy during the Cuban Missile Crisis that anything short of an airstrike on Cuba would be almost as bad as the appeasement at Munich. Yeah. He was an exceptionally gruff man to the point of hyperbolic belligerence. How did such a guy like him last as long as he did? Was it his reputation in war? Was it the fact that he was the youngest general? Was this something that was more attuned to the defense culture at the time? And how much is this responsible for the predicament that you're describing right now?
He was very good at what he did. And a lot of the liberal histories of the Cold War have portrayed him like that character in Strangelove, as this right-wing warmongering guy who secretly was trying to cause a war with the Soviet Union. And the portrait I give of him is somewhat more complex, and I came away with some real respect for his skills. I think Kennedy at one point put it best. He said something to the effect of, you never want Curtis LeMay deciding when you go to war, but when you have to go to war, you want him on your side. LeMay was an engineer. He was incredibly organized and methodical and obsessive about detail. And if you're going to have somebody managing your nuclear weapons, you want that kind of mentality. He had no tolerance for mistakes. If somebody made a mistake, the entire crew would be punished. And high-level officers, if someone under their command made a mistake, he demoted the officer. He made clear that, you know, there was no room even for bad luck because they were dealing with the most dangerous weapons. So he was all about checklists, standard operating procedures, et cetera, et cetera. Now, he did believe in having the most massive nuclear arsenal imaginable to an extent that was, you know, fairly crazy.
Yeah.
But he believed in it as a deterrent. He really believed that if the United States had this awesome nuclear arsenal, we'd never have to use it. He was also a strong opponent of the Vietnam War. He opposed the whole notion of limited wars. And he said something to the effect of, there's no such thing as a limited war for the families of the grieving, for the grieving families of those who are killed in it. If you go to war, you go to war to win, or don't fight. So the kind of quagmire of Vietnam, or the kind of quagmire that we got into in Iraq, was completely against what he believed in. Having said that, his strategy of having not 1,000, not 10,000, but, you know, by the mid-1960s, we had about 30,000 nuclear weapons, created enormous safety difficulties. And he did not believe in these safety mechanisms. He thought that his men and their esprit de corps and their discipline and their training were the best safety mechanism. But as a result, his gung-ho mentality, and I'll tell you one other thing I respect about him. He led his men into battle in the way that, you know, in the 19th century, infantry commanders would, you know, on horseback, cavalry commanders would lead their men into battle in cavalry charges. During the Second World War, he flew the lead bomber, the most dangerous place to be, on some of the most dangerous bombing raids of the Second World War. So he had this sort of gung-ho mentality, but that kind of mentality may not be what you want to have when you're talking about nuclear weapons.
Because sounds to me like he was a logical offshoot of Theodore Roosevelt and the Rough Riders.
He was very similar to that.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you talk about the notion of nuclear deterrence, which is really persuading your enemy that you really might launch if they're going to attack you, Curtis LeMay himself was a deterrent. Because by putting him in charge of our nuclear weapons, the Soviets knew this wasn't an idle threat. And again, I don't want listeners to think he was a hero of mine, and I'm very critical in the book of some of his stances. But I think the kind of simplistic caricature that history has, you know, painted of him isn't entirely accurate. You know, he was right-wing in very many ways, but he was also a champion of equal rights for women, pro-abortion, pro-labor union. It's interesting how far our political culture has moved in this country, so that the right wing right now would probably consider him a bleeding heart liberal in many ways.
But that's just fascinating to me, because here's a guy who is very gung-ho for immediate strike, who is very much against safety, and yet the suggestion I'm getting from you here in terms of presenting him as a complex figure is that he was partially needed during this very tough time of trying to face the threat of the Soviet Union. I mean, is that safe to say? Did we need to have that kind of LeMayan temperament in order to stay in this kind of arms race? Or?
We needed his organizational skills. Seriously.
Yeah.
We needed someone with no tolerance for error, who fought vehemently against a sense of complacency with nuclear weapons. We did not need his nuclear strategy. We did not need the number of weapons that his strategy created. And, you know, they're sort of between the Strategic Air Command, which is the Air Force outfit that during the Cold War had control of our weapons. There was sort of an ongoing bitterness and rivalry between them and many of the civilian weapons designers. And in a simplistic way, it's almost like, you know, James Bond being flippant about the guy Q in the white coat who says, "Be careful with this weapon, James." These Strategic Air Command guys had risked their lives in the Second World War. They'd lost their buddies in war. They were willing to take risks, and I think they were willing to take maybe too many risks with these nuclear weapons, and they should have relied a lot more on the safety mechanisms. So ultimately, would I have put Curtis LeMay in command of our nuclear weapons? I don't think so.
Yeah.
But would I have wanted some of those traits that he had in the person in command of them? Absolutely. And if you look at how our nuclear weapons are being managed today by the Air Force, we could actually use someone who is absolutely obsessed with detail, who has no tolerance whatsoever for complacency or for lax management. Just this summer, in the summer of 2013, we've had two of our three strategic missile wings cited for serious safety violations. A few years ago, we had the largest storage facility the Air Force has for nuclear weapons. The squadron that manages it, the entire squadron, was decertified. It means they were fired for safety violations. Curtis LeMay would have had those guys' head on a spike, literally. And in the Air Force, in the 50s and 60s, through the 70s, having responsibility for nuclear weapons put you in the most elite part of the Air Force. The Strategic Air Command was like the Praetorian Guard, the most elite of elite. For the last 20 years, managing nuclear weapons has been considered more of a dead end, a career dead end in the Air Force. So these guys have been pretty slack, and you don't want anyone slack with nuclear weapons. And so that's the sort of thing that I have respect for with LeMay. But his desire, you know, to have thousands of weapons and thousands, I think was hugely misguided.
Would you say he was the most ideal figure of the many flawed generals who were had control of the Strategic Air Command and so forth? Was he the best one that we had to offer? Or?
He was a product of his time.
Yeah.
And you've got to remember that Dwight Eisenhower was president, had commanded before on a huge scale in the Second World War. And he put LeMay in there to crack the whip, but he didn't put LeMay in there to tell him what decisions that we should be made. And I think ultimately LeMay was there for his organizational skills and because he sent a message to the Soviets that we meant business. Now, some of the histories have suggested that LeMay secretly, quietly tried to engineer a Third World War with the Soviets and flew his planes over the Soviet Union in order to trigger a response. I think that's bullshit. The fact of the matter is, if Curtis LeMay had wanted to start World War III, he easily could have done it. There were no locks on the bombs. There were no codes required for one of his bombers to drop them. We had real nuclear superiority over the Soviet Union in those years. If he had wanted to do it, there was nothing to prevent him from doing it. And I think it's just too simplistic to say that he wanted to commit mass slaughter so that America could be triumphant. I think that he was a more complicated person than that.
Sure. Let's talk about the Strategic Air Command.
Yeah.
One of the fascinating aspects of it is that it starts off being this heroic branch of the Army Air Corps. And Jimmy Stewart, of course, gets involved, and there's, of course, this movie that's kind of Hollywood propaganda. It quickly becomes evident that the Strategic Air Command cannot possibly keep up with this changing technology. In the epilogue, you point out that one retired Strategic Air Command general informed you that the job was like holding an angry tiger by the tail. Why couldn't the command and control system account for human exhaustion? I mean, it made an attempt with the Human Reliability System, which I like that name, in 1962. Why didn't they factor in this idea that people get exhausted? They can't have this pressure going 24/7.
Yeah. Well, they tried. But, you know, the Soviet Union and the United States were locked into this arm race that was crazy. Yeah. I mean, you know, at one point we had 32,000 nuclear weapons, and the Soviet Union at one point had 35,000 nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
And most of these nuclear weapons, the majority of those nuclear weapons, made the bombs that destroyed Hiroshima and Nagasaki seem like pipsqueaks.
Yeah.
I mean, hydrogen bombs, you know, 300, 400, 500 times more powerful than those weapons. So it was really difficult to know where all your weapons were, to make sure they were ready for use, to make sure an unauthorized person couldn't use one of them, to make sure they couldn't be stolen or sabotaged. I mean, if Walmart is doing inventory of its flat-screen TVs at their warehouse, and a warehouse worker decides he wants a flat-screen, but they manage to, you know, hold on to 31,999 of the flat-screens and only lose one, that's amazing inventory control. But with nuclear weapons, you can't afford to lose one. There's got to be perfect inventory control, and not just storing them, but being able to use them at a moment's notice. One of the people I interviewed for the book was the former Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara. And he said to me, essentially, each step seemed perfectly logical to us at the time, and they led to a place of total madness. You know, we came so close on a number of occasions to having an all-out nuclear war with the Soviet Union. We came so close on a number of occasions to having American nuclear weapons accidentally detonate on American soil. Again and again, I heard from people, and the book is really not about the high-level diplomats or national security advisors. I mean, they make appearances, but I interviewed, you know, the guys who served in launch crews, the guys who served in bomber crews, missile repairmen, weapon repairmen. Again and again, they said it was just miraculous that a major city wasn't destroyed by a nuclear weapon during the Cold War, either deliberately or inadvertently. But there's no guarantee that that luck will last.
Yeah. Well, the Damascus incident, this was not the only Titan II accident. You also describe another one in Wichita, Kansas, in which an inexperienced PTS crew disconnected the oxidizer lines during this on-the-job training, and it caused several men to die. The cause of this accident was so remarkably pedantic. It was this rubber O-ring that was blocking the poppet valve. The cause of the accident was that. But Jeff Kennedy, part of the Damascus incident, he told you that oxidizer flowed more quickly without the filter and that this meant you could get the job done quicker.
Yeah.
This kind of goes back to one of my earlier questions, but why were the PTS crews in such a rush to cut corners and to do the job quickly? I mean, this kind of goes back to issues of the pressure that's involved in maintaining these missiles, but this sounds like something that you can't really cheat at, you know?
The PTS crews, who were the maintenance crews for the Titan II missile, literally had the most dangerous job in the Air Force. The oxidizer and the rocket fuel that the missile carried, and the two of them would mix and ignite to launch the missile up in the air, they were held in separate tanks, were hugely toxic to human beings. So these guys had to wear basically spacesuits in order to handle these propellants when they went into the silo.
The RFHCO suits.
Right. They're called REFCO suits. So they had an incredibly dangerous job. They were constantly understaffed. They were working not 8-hour days, but some of them were working 16-hour days, and with equipment that was often 10, 15 years old, the suits would leak. The vapor detectors, which would tell them if there was toxic vapor nearby, were often broken. They were treated with complete disrespect by upper management.
Yeah.
And as a result, at the end of a 14-hour day, guys would cut corners. Guys would, you know, not obey the checklist because they'd give you these checklists, but sometimes you couldn't obey the checklist for the task because you didn't even have the right parts to do the checklist. So again and again, when one of these accidents would happen, the top guys at the Air Force would blame the workers. But whatever mistakes the workers made were trivial compared to the fundamental problems in the system. And again, you see in these complex technological systems, there's a bureaucratic pressure to blame the person at the bottom because it means the people at the top, firstly, don't have to assume responsibility for a deadly accident, and secondly, don't have to step back and question their own management procedures or even question the technology itself and whether it may be dangerous. And so, you know, I have enormous sympathy, empathy, and respect for these guys with high school educations, putting themselves physically at risk every time they go onto the job and being treated like crap by upper management and their superiors. And they're the ones who get sickened. They're the ones who die. And, you know, the accident in Rock, Kansas, and the accident in Damascus, Arkansas, you know, really bad missile accidents, are both due to upper management and not due to the poor guy who drops a tool or the poor guy. I mean, one of the guys who was severely injured in Rock, Kansas,
he was wearing
one of these suits that wound up leaking. It was literally the first time he'd ever been in a Titan II missile complex. He'd never done this job before. He was improperly trained to do the job. He shouldn't have even been there. And the Air Force later, when they were investigating the accident, tried to imply that it was somehow his fault, which is ridiculous.
Would you say that the REFCO suits were more of a placebo effect to make these men feel that they were safer inside the Titan II silo? I mean, is that safe
to say? No, these REFCO suits, and again, it's like if you can imagine a white suit with a bubble helmet that looks like a really cool space suit from a 1960s Japanese, you know, Godzilla movie. I mean, it was just a ridiculous-looking thing, but when it was brand new and it was well-maintained, it worked. You know, it was supposed to give you about an hour worth of air, and this oxidizer and this fuel was totally deadly if you breathed it. It was totally toxic if it got onto your skin.
Yeah.
The fuel could give you, you know, all kinds of problems by being absorbed through the skin. The oxidizer would burn your skin like acid, and it was an essential thing to be wearing. The problem was, by 1980, you know, there were so many patches on these things that they looked like, you know, a pauper suit. The air packs were now defective, and instead of an hour of air, you couldn't rely on getting more than a half hour of air out of them. And it was hugely, hugely irresponsible of the Air Force to put 18, 19, 20-year-old guys into a dangerous situation with equipment that was defective, and it was done on a routine basis.
Were there any efforts to get the REFCO suits replaced by 1980? I mean, obviously this is something in which you are basically creating expendable engineers, expendable servicemen, and given the risk of missiles, it seems to me that this would be a high priority. Make sure your men are safe. Make sure that the suits they use are absolutely pristine. Make sure that they can actually do the job. Make sure that they actually have the full hour of air they need to go ahead and do their work, you know?
Yeah, but that's just common sense.
Yeah.
And, you know, particularly in the late 1970s, early 1980s, the military felt like it was running out of money and it would rather buy new weapons than maintain the old ones. In the case of this REFCO suit, they realized after this accident in Rock, Kansas, that the suit was defective. One of the ways it was defective is that the gloves were separate from the main body of the suit, and you had something you rolled over the gloves. But if it got hit by something at high pressure, if the fuel was coming out at high pressure, it would push its way past the glove. So one of the solutions they came up with and that they put out in a tech order as a recommendation is use black electrical tape to tape your gloves onto your suit. Now, I mean, you know, I love duct tape, and I always have it around the house for all kinds of uses. But if I'm going to go into a missile silo with deadly gases wearing essentially a spacesuit, I don't want my life depending on the duct tape ceiling. And that's the kind of patchwork, you know, solutions that the Air Force was coming up with for a weapon system that was way past its prime.
So there were a number of bombs that accidentally fell off of out of bombers, which I was just fascinated by. A bomb that dropped on a house in South Carolina, which thankfully didn't contain a nuclear core. The Mark 39 hydrogen bombs that fell from a B-52 because of all things, a loose arming wire. I mean, you were talking about permanent action links, but we're talking a loose arming wire. One of the bombs wasn't even discovered in the Nahunta Swamp. There is, of course, the incident in Spain that you actually write about. One would think that after, maybe one loose bomb, maybe we would have learned our lesson, especially because you have these tetchy B-52s. But these B-52s, as problematic as they are, I mean, they are still expected to remain in service through 2040. Why have we relied so long on such an aging and problematic infrastructure for this system? It's absolutely mind-boggling.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's the laws of probability and
the law of averages.
And when you talk about Curtis LeMay and the operation he ran on a day-in, day-out basis, it was remarkably efficient and effective. But from, you know, the early 1960s through about 68, they wanted to have bombers up every day in the sky, 24 hours a day, ready to fly and strike the Soviet Union. And, you know, that's Failsafe, the film Failsafe and Strangelove are about those airborne alert bombers, B-52s, that are just flying around at all times. Now, you think about the fact that day in, day out, they've got those bombers flying, and most of the time there's no problem whatsoever. But it's hard to have a perfect safety record, and there's something inherently dangerous about having bombers up in the air with hydrogen bombs. Yeah. And, you know, after the accident in Thule, Greenland, they stopped that airborne alert because there was something slightly crazy about it. Over Goldsboro, North Carolina, this bomber began to break up midair because of a weight imbalance. And as it was breaking apart midair, the centrifugal forces pulled on a lanyard in the cockpit. And that's exactly the lanyard that a crew member would pull if they were over the Soviet Union to drop their hydrogen bomb. So this hydrogen bomb had no way of knowing it was over North Carolina and not over the Soviet Union. And it went through all of its proper arming steps except for one. And when it hit the ground, the firing signal was sent. And if it had gone through that one other step, it would have detonated full scale in North Carolina. And this was just a few days after John F. Kennedy was inaugurated. It would have changed the course of history.
Yeah.
But, you know, huge risks were being taken. Now, the B-52 was never designed to fly around fully loaded with hydrogen bombs or nuclear weapons until it was going to drop them. The B-52 was designed right after the Second World War. We haven't built one since 1962, and yet right now most of the bombers that we have to carry nuclear weapons are B-52 bombers. They've gotten new avionics, they've been updated, but essentially it's the same airframe, you know, that goes back to 1962. And we can argue about, well, should we have nuclear weapons at all? Should we have 300 of them, as some people now argue, or 400 of them? Should we have 5,000 of them, which is pretty much as the number we have? But my argument is going to be, you know, if we're going to have any of them, you spare no expense in how you manage them.
Yeah.
And you make sure the equipment is as up-to-date as humanly possible. And the people who work with them should be really well-paid, really well-trained, really well-screened, and their morale should be really good, because it's just the height of irresponsibility to have the most dangerous machines ever made being looked after by people who feel like they're not treated well, who may be suffering from poor morale, who may have psychological difficulties. And, you know, I'm concerned about the management of our arsenal right now.
Yeah. Let's talk also about Kissinger's efforts to get rid of the Titan II. I mean, he was no slouch in other belligerent activities, but he looked at the single integrated operation plan against the Soviet Union, and he was appalled. The minimum attack option was hitting the Soviet Union with 2,000 weapons. That was the SIOP. The greatest was more than 3,000. Kissinger described this as a horror strategy, and Nixon himself was appalled. And you describe how the initial SIOP had to be completed within 4 months during the Eisenhower administration with the development of a target weighing system. But given how Eisenhower himself opposed, in his words, a 100% pulverization of the Soviet Union, why did this operation plan leave pretty much no room for subtlety?
Well, you know, it gets back to what I, you know, the quote of McNamara.
Yeah.
Each step made perfect sense, and it led to a place of total madness.
It seemed the right idea at the time, yeah.
You know, the reason we came up with a single integrated operational plan, nicknamed the PSYOP. Now, the PSYOP sounds like the villain in, you know, a fantasy or science fiction film, is because there was a realization in the late 1950s that because of the rivalry between the Air Force and the Navy, they hadn't even been sharing their targets with one another. So it turned out that, you know, Air Force planes and Navy planes were going to wind up over the same target at the same time and hit targets in the Soviet Union multiple times. There was no coordination whatsoever. So it was an attempt to come up with something rational. And yet what came out of it was just profoundly irrational. There was a desire, basically, to destroy the military of the Soviet Union. The Air Force and the Strategic Air Command wanted to destroy every military target, and they wanted to strike first. They wanted the United States to strike first so the Soviets couldn't launch any missiles or send any bombers towards us. The Navy didn't want to do that. The Navy thought the best way to deter the Soviet Union was to threaten to hit their cities,
yeah,
because the Navy's missiles on their submarines were very inaccurate. And Eisenhower had to kind of arbitrate this battle between the Air Force and the Navy. The solution was a compromise that had this wonderful euphemism, the optimum mix. And the compromise was, well, we'll hit both.
Yeah.
So about 80% of the targets in the PSYOP were military targets. But the other 20% were the cities, the major cities of the Soviet Union and China and the Eastern Bloc. The PSYOP, the nuclear war plan of the United States, was the most closely guarded secret that our military had. And they didn't want any civilians to see it because they didn't want there to be any espionage, any of it to leak. So I write about in the book how high-level Defense Department officials, who are civilians, or national security advisors like Kissinger, enter office, and they're given a briefing on the PSYOP, and it totally and completely blows their mind. I mean, Kissinger had made his reputation in the 1950s as a nuclear strategist. He had written books on nuclear strategy.
Surprise bestsellers.
He gets his first briefing on the PSYOP, and his jaw drops. And Henry Kissinger is so far from a peacenik at this point, it's beyond belief. And it later turns out, classified documents have now been released that show that the Strategic Air Command kept details of the PSYOP away from Kissinger. There were all these bureaucratic rivalries between the Air Force and the Navy, between the military and civilians, between one weapons lab and another weapons lab. This was all about who is going to control our weapons. And again, it led to just extraordinary, extraordinary numbers of weapons being built that were going to be used in unbelievable ways. And, you know, the same story happened when William Odom, who was worked for Carter's national security advisor, when he got his first briefing on the PSYOP, and he was far from being, you know, a disarmer. He was a very conservative army general, and he looked at the number of weapons that were involved. One of the most extraordinary things of our nuclear war plan was once you started it, it couldn't be stopped. It was this mechanistic war plan that once you launched it, there were no calling the missiles back. It was all going to unfold with extraordinary amount of damage and so much fallout that it would have hurt our allies like South Korea and Japan. Our own military bases would have gotten hit with lethal radioactive fallout because we were just going to shoot everything we had at the Soviet Union and try to wipe them out before they could fire anything at us.
There's also one other interesting aspect of all this, especially around the Cuban Missile Crisis, the interplay between Kennedy and Khrushchev. What's fascinating is that there is actually no direct private cable between the United States and the Soviet Union. And what's also interesting is that Kennedy is in the process of trying to respond to Khrushchev, and then he goes ahead, and as he's drafting his response, Khrushchev announces on public radio in Moscow what he wants to do. So you would think that a system this complex would not only allow for human mistake, human exhaustion, but also human diplomacy.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's fascinating that we kept this in operation while you had world leaders who would likely just flip from the lip like this. You know, I mean, how can you be a diplomat when you know the system is in action? It begs the question.
Well, you know, and let me just get back to the PSYOP very briefly and our war plan. As bad as our war plan was, I can just about guarantee you the Soviets were planning to do exactly the same thing to us.
Yeah.
And particularly in, you know, the earlier part of the Cold War, they had fewer weapons than us.
Yeah.
So their most effective strategy would have been to launch first, hit our, you know, command centers, destroy Washington, D.C., destroy Omaha, Nebraska, where the headquarters of the Strategic Air Command is, and do what was known then as a decapitation attack. And it's not as though, you know, the Soviets publicly had this no first use policy. We would never introduce weapons into the battlefield first. And after the Cold War ended, you know, in East Germany, they found some Soviet war plans that, you know, we always assumed the tanks were going to roll across Germany because the Soviet Union had such superiority on the ground. But one of these war plans said, well, first they're going to launch their nuclear weapons into Germany and then they're going to roll the tanks. So there was huge, enormous blame on both sides here. And by no means did I set out to write a simplistic anti-American book, because there wasn't a rough equivalency between the United States and the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union killed tens of millions of people, and the people in Eastern Europe were basically kept in a form of slavery. And, you know, we may not have been perfect, but we were better than the Soviets. When it came to the Cuban Missile Crisis, it's remarkable, because you see all these films where the Soviet leader calls up the American leader on the phone, and, you know, that happened in Failsafe.
Yeah.
That happens in Strange Love, and the Peter Sellers character playing the president saying, but Dmitry, you know, and the Soviet Union, the head of the Soviet Union is drunk. During the Cuban Missile Crisis, there was no phone.
Yeah.
There was no hotline. They were communicating by Western Union telegram. And the Soviet ambassador in Washington later said he was afraid that the Western Union guy who was supposed to deliver the telegram to the Soviet embassy might start hanging out with his girlfriend instead and not deliver the telegram in time, and World War III might break out. That's why some of these messages were actually delivered through public speeches and addresses. There was so much miscommunication during that crisis, so many back channels that might be unreliable, that a hotline was created after the Cuban Missile Crisis. And it wasn't a telephone like in the movies. It was a teletype machine, because they wanted to make sure that it was written communication, that there'd be no mistakes of interpretation of. It's remarkable how close we came to war.
The way to end this is to ask about the present risk of nuclear war in South Asia. I mean, today, as we're talking, Al-Shabaab has made an attack in Nairobi. There's, of course, the Pakistan incident and things like that, the church. In terms of safety and maintenance, I mean, what similarities are there between the Pakistan of today and the United States of the mid-20th century?
There's a great deal to be concerned about. Perhaps the most disturbing thing that came out of Snowden's revelations, yeah, you know, the documents he got from the NSA, I mean, paranoid investigative journalists like myself always assume that any form of communication just about is going to be able to be monitored by the government. Your email, your cell phone, your phone. I was sort of surprised that they scan every letter that the U.S. mail, you know, takes. Every envelope that's handled by the U.S. Postal Service is scanned. Yeah. That was a surprise. But basically, the most disturbing thing that Snowden found was an intelligence report that showed the United States really has no idea how Pakistan is managing its nuclear weapons, how it moves them, how it stores them, and that's of great concern. There are extremists in the world and in Pakistan who would really like one of their nuclear weapons. Bad as the animosity was between the Soviet Union and the United States, you know, we were 6,000 miles away. We hated one another ideologically. But there's something about the hatred you feel for your neighbor, who you live right beside, who you may have ethnic and religious differences with, and that fits the India-Pakistan bill perfectly. The United States and the Soviet Union were both largely secular countries with leadership that wanted to live. You mentioned the terrorist attack today.
Yeah.
We now have a religious fanaticism that celebrates suicide, that will reward suicide with, you know, wonderful gifts in the afterlife. You don't want these people having a nuclear weapon, because the sort of deterrence theory that helped keep the peace in the Soviet Union doesn't apply to people who are just fine about dying, or just fine with suicide. So, you know, whereas I think the risk today of an all-out nuclear war is vastly lower than it was during the Cold War, the risk of a nuclear weapon, of a single weapon actually being used by a terrorist, through an accident, I think we probably, my book is full of criticism of the management of the American arsenal. I think that we probably build the best weapons, the safest weapons. We probably have the most technologically proficient command and control system. But if we've had this many problems, think about India, think about Pakistan, think about North Korea. At the end of the book, I look at a country's rate of industrial accidents as a rough measure of their ability to manage complex technological systems. And, we should be concerned about Pakistan, greatly concerned.
What else did Sean Gregory tell you? You alluded to that, the end, and I was wondering what specifically he told you that he hadn't said.
Well, you know, one of the issues throughout the history of the Cold War is, if you want to control your weapons as much as possible, you put them in one storage facility and you guard that storage facility like you can't believe. But if you do that, that storage facility becomes just a prime target for your adversary, because your adversary then hits that storage facility and you lose all of your weapons. Now, that's a big issue for Pakistan right now. To the degree that they want to keep their weapons safe from extremists, they put them all in one place. But if they're all in one place, then India could strike that facility. If you disperse your weapons and put them in many different facilities, you're safe against an attack by India, but your weapons might be more likely to be stolen by your own troops or by extremists. And unfortunately, it looks like Pakistan has followed that second course and dispersed its weapons. And in order to have its weapons as far away from India as possible, so that the storage facilities can't be overrun by Indian troops, you know, it's put weapons close to some of the northwest provinces, where you have the most religious extremism in Pakistan. So you have weapons dispersed near areas where they're most likely to be stolen. And again, we don't know this for sure, because there's enormous secrecy around the Pakistan program. But that's what looks like is the case. And that's the most likely scenario for having one of these weapons stolen or used without authorization.
Eric, thanks very much. It was a pleasure to chat.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks. Fantastic.